Chapter 1. The History of Psychonautics, Ancient, Aboriginal, and Modern Technologies of the Sacred. Part 2.
The Ethnomycological Research of Gordon and Valentina Pavlovna Wasson. Gordon Wasson and his wife, Russian pediatrician Valentina Pavlovna, were important protagonists during this chapter of history. Gordon was the most unlikely person to become involved with anything related to psychonautics. He was a successful New York banker and vice president of the J.P. Morgan Trust Company. This remarkable story began in 1927, when he and his young wife were on their belated honeymoon in the Catskill Mountains. During one of their strolls in the forest, Valentina Pavlovna collected wild mushrooms and insisted on preparing them for dinner. As a typical Anglo-Saxon, Gordon was a mycophobe, a term that he later coined for people who believe that the only edible mushrooms are those found in the supermarket, and who refer to any kind of wild mushrooms as toadstools. He was horrified at the prospect of eating wild mushrooms, and tried unsuccessfully to dissuade his wife from cooking them. Valentina, being a mycophile, the term Gordon later used for Eastern European mushroom enthusiasts, prevailed and prepared a delicious dinner with wild mushrooms as the main ingredient. Gordon reluctantly tasted her dish and liked it very much. The next morning, when he discovered to his great surprise that both he and Valentina were still alive and well, he experienced a dramatic conversion from a mycophobe to a mycophile. This experience awakened a profound lifelong interest in mushrooms, and he became a world-famous amateur ethnomycologist. Gordon and Valentina spent the next 20 years studying the role mushrooms had played in human history, archaeology, comparative religion, folklore, and mythology. This extensive research culminated in the publication of their colossal, lavishly produced bibliophile opus, Mushrooms, Russia, and History, in which the Wassons concluded that mushroom worship was a significant component of pre-literate humanity's religious life in most of Eurasia and the Americas. They were particularly fascinated by the ritual use of the psychoactive mushroom Amanita muscaria by the shamans of the Finno-Ugrians and other far north Eurasian peoples. This interest led them to eventually discover the writings of Bernardino de Sahagún, a Franciscan missionary priest involved in the Catholic evangelization of New Spain, and to the ritual use of magic mushrooms in pre-Hispanic cultures, as well as contemporary Central America. After 3 field trips to Mexico, they found Maria Sabina, the Mazatec curandera, medicine woman, who was using psychoactive mushrooms, known in Mesoamerica as Teonanacatl, or the flesh of gods, in her healing ceremonies. In June 1955, the Wassons and their friend, New York photographer Alan Richardson, became the first known Westerners allowed to participate in Maria Sabina's mushroom ritual, called Velada. Their book, Mushrooms, Russia, and History, gave the first account of the Wassons' encounter with Maria Sabina and their experience with magic mushrooms. They were deeply impressed by the powerful effects of the mushrooms from Maria Sabina's velada. They collected samples of the mushrooms and sent them to Europe for botanical identification. The Wassons sought the help of Roger Heim, a famous French botanist specializing in mycology and tropical phytopathology, who identified the Teonanacatl mushrooms as Psilocybe mexicana and its congeners. Heim was able to cultivate some of these mushrooms in his laboratory, and he and Gordon sent samples to the laboratories of the Swiss pharmaceutical company Sandoz for chemical analysis. In a brilliant chemical tour de force, Albert Hofmann was able to identify and synthesize 2 active alkaloids responsible for the effect of psilocybe mushrooms. and gave them the names psilocybin and psilocin. Sandoz produced large quantities of dragées of the two new psychedelics and made them available for laboratory and clinical research worldwide. Albert Hofmann's next contribution to the history of psychonautics was the isolation of the active principle from the seeds of the morning glory Rhevea corymbosa, known among the natives as Ololiuki, which Gordon Wasson obtained from a Zapotec native. To Albert's great surprise, the active alkaloid turned out to be a monoethylamide of lysergic acid, LAE32, only one ethyl group different from LSD25. It was so unlikely that lysergic acid derivatives could be produced by plants that far apart on the evolutionary ladder, the fungus ergot and the flowering plant Rhevea corymbosa, that Albert's colleagues accused him of contaminating his sample of Ololiuki with lysergic acid from his lab. However, the identification of the alkaloid proved to be correct, and Albert concluded that LSD should be considered a member of the group of pre-Hispanic sacraments. As we saw earlier, mescaline, ibogaine, and harmine, benisterine, had already been isolated and chemically identified earlier in the 20th century. The armamentarium of psychedelic substances was further enriched by psychoactive derivatives of tryptamine, DMT-dimethyltryptamine, DET-diethyltryptamine, and DPT-dipropyltryptamine, synthesized and studied by the Budapest group of chemists headed by Stephen Zara and Zoltán Buzermi. DMT and 5-methoxy-DMT were recognized as the active principles of the psychedelic secretions of the parotid glands and skins of the toad Bufo alvarius, and as an important ingredient of ayahuasca, meaning soga de los muertos, or vine of the dead. For centuries, this remarkable potion had the reputation of a miraculous medicine in the native cultures of South America. In 1964, Israeli chemist Rafael Mishulam made another important contribution to psychonautics when he isolated, identified, and synthesized tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, the psychoactive principle from cannabis, marijuana, and hashish. Mishulam's original experiments were conducted in the early 1960s on hashish acquired from a local police station. His research revealed the extraordinary psychoactive and medicinal potential of this unique plant compound. Mishulam also successfully elucidated and isolated the second most abundant cannabinol, cannabidiol, CBD, which turned out to be a powerful analgesic. It has other therapeutic effects, but does not induce a holotropic state of consciousness. Rafael Mishulam is still continuing his research, and along with his co-workers, has isolated and identified a large number of cannabinols with a broad range of useful clinical effects. He realized that it is not happenstance that humans use cannabis. In 1992, he found that the human body naturally produces its own internal cannabinoids that regulate human mood, pain, memory, and more. For his research, he has received many national and international awards and earned the name the grandfather of cannabis. His work is becoming increasingly important with the progress in the decriminalization of marijuana. By the 1960s, a wide range of psychedelic alkaloids in pure form was available to researchers. It became possible to study their properties in the laboratory and explore the phenomenology of the experiences that they induce, as well as their therapeutic potential. The psychopharmacological revolution triggered by Albert Hofmann's serendipitous discovery of LSD and the hunt for toxin X were underway. In 1954, Woolley and Shaw formulated a biochemical theory of schizophrenia based on the antagonism between LSD-25 and serotonin, 5-hydroxytryptamine. Abram Hoffer and Humphrey Osmond proposed that schizophrenia might be caused by the abnormal metabolism of adrenaline resulting in the psychedelic derivatives adrenochrome and adrenalutin. The influence of LSD on the Siamese fighting fish Betta splendens led to a hypothesis suggesting that its effects and schizophrenia might be explained by interference with the transfer of oxygen on the subcellular level. This was based on the observation that adding LSD-25 to the tank with these fish elicited several types of characteristic abnormal behavior similar to those caused by cyanide compounds. Albert's Wonder Child. Although these biochemical theories of schizophrenia were eventually refuted and abandoned, LSD remained at the center of attention for researchers. Never before had a single substance held so much promise in such a wide variety of fields. For psychopharmacologists and neurophysiologists, the discovery of LSD meant the beginning of a golden era of research that could solve many puzzles concerning neuroreceptors, synaptic transmitters, chemical antagonisms, and the intricate biochemical interactions underlying cerebral processes. For historians and art critics, the LSD experiments provided extraordinary new insights into the psychology and psychopathology of art. This was particularly true for paintings and sculptures of various native, so-called primitive cultures, psychiatric patients, and outsider art, l'art brut, as well as various modern movements such as abstractionism, impressionism, cubism, pointillism, surrealism, fantastic realism, and dadaism. For professional painters who participated in LSD research, the psychedelic session often marked a radical change in their artistic expression. Their imagination became much richer, their colors more vivid, their style considerably freer. They could also often reach into the deep recesses of their unconscious psyche and tap archetypal sources of inspiration. On occasion, people who had never painted before were able to produce extraordinary pieces of art. LSD experimentation also produced fascinating observations that were of great interest to spiritual teachers and scholars of comparative religion. The mystical experiences frequently observed in LSD sessions offered a radically new understanding of a wide variety of phenomena from the spiritual domain, including shamanism, rites of passage, ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, Eastern religions and philosophies, and mystical traditions of the world. The fact that LSD and other psychedelic substances were able to trigger a broad range of spiritual experiences became the subject of heated scientific discussions. These debates revolved around the fascinating problem concerning the nature and value of this instant or chemical mysticism. As Walter Pankey demonstrated in his famous Good Friday experiment, mystical experiences induced by psychedelics are indistinguishable from those described in mystical literature. This finding, which was recently confirmed in a meticulous study by Roland Griffiths and Bill Richards, researchers at Johns Hopkins University, has important theoretical and legal implications. LSD was highly recommended as an extraordinary unconventional teaching device that would make it possible for psychiatrists, psychologists, medical students, and nurses to spend a few hours in a world resembling that of their patients. As a result of this experience, they would be able to understand them better, communicate with them more effectively, and be more successful in their treatment. Thousands of mental health professionals took advantage of this unique opportunity. These experiments brought surprising and astonishing results. They not only provided deep insights into the inner world of psychiatric patients, They also revolutionized the understanding of the vast dimensions of the human psyche and the nature of consciousness. As a result of their experiences, many professionals realized that the current model of the psyche, limiting the psyche to postnatal biography and the Freudian individual unconscious, is superficial and inadequate. My own attempt to create a map of the psyche that would adequately portray the experiential spectrum of psychedelic sessions required a radical expansion of the model of the psyche used by mainstream psychiatry by adding two large regions. The first of them, the perinatal domain, is closely related to the memory of biological birth. And the second, the transpersonal domain, overlaps to some extent with C.G. Jung's historical and archetypal collective unconscious, although it expands and modifies it. The perinatal and transpersonal domains will play an important role in later chapters of this book. Early experiments with LSD and other psychedelics also showed that the roots of emotional and psychosomatic disorders were not limited to traumatic memories from childhood and infancy, as traditional psychiatrists assume, but reach much deeper into the psyche, into the perinatal and transpersonal regions. Reports from psychedelic psychotherapists revealed LSD's unique potential as a powerful tool that can deepen and accelerate the psychotherapeutic process. With LSD as a catalyst, psychotherapy can be useful for categories of patients that previously had been difficult to reach: alcoholics, narcotic drug addicts, criminal recidivists, and sexual deviants. LSD psychotherapy also proved to be particularly useful in terminal cancer patients. In a large percentage of these patients, LSD alleviated or even eliminated difficult emotional symptoms, such as depression, general tension, anger, and insomnia. In the studies with cancer patients, LSD also showed remarkable analgesic properties. It often relieved severe physical pain, sometimes even in those patients who had not previously responded to medication with narcotics. In some instances, the analgesic effect of LSD was not limited to the duration of the pharmacological action of the substance, but continued for several weeks. The most important effect that LSD had in dying cancer patients was the significant reduction or even disappearance of their fear of death. This happened in spite of the fact that they knew they would die within days or months. As a result, the quality of their life was greatly enhanced during the remaining days, and their experience of dying was positively transformed. After 40 years, during which clinical use of psychedelics was blocked by irrational and ignorant legislation, these results are now being confirmed by a new generation of researchers with the use of LSD and psilocybin. The most interesting and important development in the first decades of psychedelic research was the shift from the reductionist laboratory perspective to the understanding of a much larger, revolutionary, and paradigm-breaking potential of psychedelics. It became obvious to those therapists who had the privilege of working with them that these substances are unique tools for consciousness research and the exploration of the deep recesses of the human psyche, as well as extraordinary therapeutic agents. The far-reaching philosophical implications of this research are now supported by revolutionary evidence from other disciplines, including cosmology, quantum relativistic physics, systems theory, and biology. My own early work with psychedelics was laboratory research comparing the changes in psychological, biochemical, and electrophysiological tests after the administration of psychedelics to psychotic patients. The most intriguing finding in this stage of research was the extraordinary inter-individual and intra-individual variability in the experiences of the participants in the study. The same substance administered in the same dosage and in the same set and setting resulted in radically different experiences in each of the subjects. Some sessions consisted mostly of beautiful, abstract, geometrical visions, while others brought the reliving of childhood memories and interesting psychological insights. In some sessions, the only symptoms were unpleasant physical sensations. In others, experiences of emotional and physical well-being, or even ecstatic rapture. Some subjects had episodes with a paranoid perception of the environment, or a tendency toward manic behavior. The same variability could be observed in a series of psychedelic sessions of the same individuals. Each of the serial sessions was different, sometimes quite significantly, and even in diametrically opposite ways. This unpredictability of the effects made me realize that we were not doing ordinary pharmacological research, that is, working with substances that have predictable effects, but doing something much more interesting. We were exploring the deep domains of the human psyche with the help of powerful catalysts. As a result, I lost interest in the laboratory research of psychedelics and started exploring their potential as tools for exploration of the psyche and adjuncts to psychotherapy. In my first book, Realms of the Human Unconscious, I suggested that the potential significance of LSD for psychiatry and psychology is comparable to the importance of the microscope for biology and medicine, or the telescope for astronomy. The microscope revealed the existence of the microworld, and the telescope revealed the depth of the universe, domains which had been previously unknown. LSD makes it possible to study deep processes in the psyche that are not normally available for observation. For the general population, the turning point in the attitude toward psychedelics was the correspondence between Aldous Huxley and Humphrey Osmond, in which they were trying to find an appropriate, non-clinical name for the new category of substances. This competition was carried out in an exchange of poems. Aldous Huxley sent Humphrey Osmond a rhyme containing his own suggestion for a new name. To make this trivial world sublime, take half a gram of phanerothyme. Humphrey Osmond countered with, to fathom hell or soar angelic, just take a pinch of psychedelic. Osmond's term psychedelic, the winner in this contest, all but replaced the terms hallucinogenic, psychotomimetic, or delirogenic, and experimental psychosis, all of which suggest pathology, with a much friendlier and more appropriate name. Psychedelic, from the Greek psuche and delun, meaning make visible, literally means revealing or manifesting the psyche. The use of this word by the counterculture of the 1960s played a decisive role in the naming process. Today, we see terms like hallucinogens and psychotomimetics only in the articles of researchers who need to be seen as serious scientists by conservative and biased authorities. Shifting the focus from the reductionist and pathological orientation to the exploration of consciousness and the farther reaches of the human psyche made it possible to amass fascinating insights into many different areas. The architecture of emotional and psychosomatic disorders, human sexuality, the ritual and spiritual life of ancient and native cultures, the great religions of the world, mystical traditions, death and dying, the psychology of art and artists, and archetypal astrology, as well as other problems. We will explore these insights in future chapters of this encyclopedia. The interest in the therapeutic potential of psychedelics generated by clinical experimentation with LSD-25 and psilocybin also inspired some therapists to take a closer look at the less-known psychoactive substances, which had been known since the beginning of the 20th century, but primarily only from the chemical and pharmacological point of view. Chilean-American psychiatrist Claudio Naranjo, taking advantage of the favorable legal situation in his native country, conducted a pioneering clinical study with pure alkaloids from psychedelic plants ibogaine and harmaline, and with MDA and MMDA, two amphetamine derivatives structurally similar to mescaline. Claudio described this study in his book, The Healing Journey: New Approaches to Psychedelic Therapy. He paid special attention to the spiritual and psychotherapeutic potential of these substances. To distinguish them from classical psychedelics, such as LSD, mescaline, and psilocybin, Naranjo coined for them the terms emotion enhancers and fantasy enhancers. In later years, most researchers preferred the name entheogens, literally generating God within. Psychonautics driven underground by irrational legislation. Psychedelic research seemed to be on its way to fulfill its initial promises and expectations, until the unfortunate Harvard affair involving Tim Leary, Richard Alpert, and Ralph Metzner, as well as the unsupervised mass self-experimentation and counterculture of the young generation, which turned Albert Hofmann's wonder child into a problem child. The problems associated with this development were also blown out of proportion by sensation-hunting journalists. The ignorant administrative and political sanctions against psychedelics in the 1960s were effective only against law-obeying scientists, but famously failed to stop the street use of psychedelic substances. The draconian legal sanctions against psychedelics and the deceptive and mendacious anti-drug propaganda actually motivated the rebellious young generation to experiment with them. This also encouraged a black market filled with dangerous products of uncertain quality and dosage, creating an absurd situation in which an average teenager knew more about psychedelics, consciousness, and the human psyche than mainstream psychiatrists and psychologists. Robert Kennedy, whose wife had been treated with LSD and benefited from the experience, brought up this issue in a 1966 hearing of his own subcommittee on LSD. He questioned the officials of the Federal Drug and Food Administration, FDA, and National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, officials why so many LSD research projects were getting scrapped. Defending LSD research, he pointed out that it was bizarre to stop legitimate scientific research with psychedelic substances at a time when millions of Americans were using them. This situation should have made it imperative to acquire as much reliable information about them as possible. The drastic legislation that killed serious legitimate research of psychedelics for four decades was not based on any scientific evidence, but actually ignored the existing clinical data. For example, in 1960, Los Angeles psychedelic pioneer Sidney Cohen published an article entitled "Lysergic Acid Diethylamide: Side Effects and Complications," based on 25,000 administrations of LSD-25 and mescaline. He showed that problems associated with psychedelics, such as flashbacks, prolonged reactions, psychotic breaks, and suicidal attempts, were actually minimal in the responsible use of these substances. They compared very favorably with other procedures routinely used by mainstream psychiatrists, such as insulin comas and electroconvulsive therapy. For both of them, 1% mortality was considered an acceptable medical risk. Edgar Monitz's widely used Nobel Prize-winning prefrontal lobotomy, causing irreversible ravaging damage to vast areas of the brain and occasionally turning much of the hemisphere into a hemorrhagic cyst, is in a category of its own in this regard. Those of us who were privileged to have personal experiences with psychedelics and to use them in our work were aware of the great promise that they represented, not only for psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy, but also for modern society in general. We were deeply saddened by the mass hysteria that pervaded not only the lay population, but also the clinical and academic circles. One aspect of this national hysteria deserves special attention because it shows the mendacious nature of the anti-drug propaganda and the role dishonest sensation-hunting journalists played in it. In the late 1960s, Maimoun Cohen and his colleagues, researchers from the State University of New York in Buffalo, New York, observed structural changes in the chromosomes of children whose mothers had taken LSD during pregnancy. Structural changes in chromosomes have been observed in earlier experiments with commonly used drugs, such as aspirin, caffeine, and tetracyclic antibiotics. Dr. Cohen himself was very cautious in interpreting these results and emphasized that all these children were born healthy and normal. An irresponsible journalist published an article with a large blurred photograph of a baby and the headline, "If you take LSD only once, you can have a deformed baby." The absurdity of this statement is obvious, since a certain number of babies can be born unhealthy no matter what the mother does or does not do. The method used in the study was itself flawed, as we discovered in a joint study with Jo Hin Tiju, the Indonesian-American NIH cytogeneticist who had developed the method. In this joint study, Dr. Tiju was not able to distinguish the blood of our patients who had taken high doses of LSD from the blood of controls. Walter Houston Clark, who worked in our institute for several months as a volunteer, was able to obtain the blood of Timothy Leary after Leary had taken many hundreds of doses of LSD and sent it to Dr. Tiju as one of the samples. Dr. Tiju was not able to detect anything unusual in Tim Leary's blood. I included an extensive review of the literature on LSD, chromosomes, and genetics as an appendix in my book, LSD Psychotherapy. The national hysteria involving psychedelics tragically compromised and criminalized tools with extraordinary therapeutic potential that, properly understood and used, had the power to counteract the destructive and self-destructive tendencies of industrial civilization. It was particularly heartbreaking to see the reaction of Albert Hofmann, the father of LSD and other psychedelics, as he watched his prodigious wonder child turn into a problem child, and his vision of a new Eleusis rapidly fade away. Some of the psychedelic researchers resigned themselves to the situation and returned reluctantly to routine psychiatric practice that now seemed lifeless and dull after they had experienced the excitement of the new therapeutic perspectives. Others, aware of the limitations of verbal therapy, decided to use experiential approaches that do not use substances. A large number of therapists convinced of the value of psychedelics decided not to deprive their clients of the benefits offered by these substances and continued their work underground, or found legal loopholes that allowed them to continue their work legally or semi-legally. Thanks to this development, the expertise of assisting in psychedelic sessions did not become an extinct trade. The Shulgins and the Era of Entheogens. Despite all the legal difficulties, the four decades during which mainstream research was made virtually impossible became an extremely important chapter in the history of psychonautics. The credit for this goes to Alexander Theodore Sasha Shulgin, a brilliant Californian organic chemist, psychopharmacologist, and author. Sasha developed a new method for the synthesis of 3,4-methylenedioxy-N-methylamphetamine, MDMA, later called XTC or ecstasy, a substance developed in the early 1900s in Germany by Merck, intended as a parent compound to be used to synthesize other pharmaceuticals. In 1976, he introduced the substance to Leo Zeff, a Jungian psychologist from Oakland, California. Leo introduced the substance to hundreds of psychologists and lay therapists around the nation. In the late 1970s, MDMA became very popular as a psychotherapeutic tool, particularly effective for work with couples and with people suffering from post-traumatic stress. Due to its proclivity to induce experiences of empathy, sympathy, emotional closeness, openness, and oneness, MDMA has been often referred to as an empathogen or entactogen, from the Greek en, meaning in, and the Latin tactus, meaning touch. It has the reputation of having saved many threatened relationships and marriages. Sasha Shulgin embarked on a phenomenal tour de force during which he synthesized a large number of psychoactive substances. Starting in 1960, he and his wife Anne enlisted a small group of friends with whom he regularly tested his creations. They developed a systematic way of ranking the effects of various substances, known as the Shulgin Rating Scale, with a vocabulary to describe their visual, auditory, and physical effects. Sasha personally tested hundreds of drugs, mainly analogs of various phenethylamines, a group containing MDMA, mescaline, and the 2C family of psychedelics, phenethylamines that have methoxy groups on the 2 and 5 positions of a benzene ring, and tryptamines, N,N-dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and 4-methoxy-DMT, psilocybin, and psilocin. There exists a large number of slight chemical variations with differences in effect, all of which are meticulously recorded in the Shulgin's laboratory notebooks. In 1991 and 1997, Sasha and his wife Anne published the findings from many years of their unparalleled research in 2 volumes with the esoteric names Pikal and Tikal. These books are treasure troves of information for psychonauts and have, since the time of their publication, become classics in the field. The cryptic titles of these volumes combine the technical information about their content with a testimony for the Shulgin's passion for their extraordinary quest. Pikal stands for Phenethylamines I Have Known and Loved, and Tikal is an acronym for Tryptamines I Have Known and Loved. Thanks to his remarkable work in the field of psychedelic research and the rational drug design of psychedelic substances, Sasha has since been dubbed the godfather of psychedelics. Sasha was and is admired and loved by thousands of people who benefited from his work and had their lives positively transformed by the substances he developed. Those of us who had the chance to visit his home and see his laboratory could not believe that it was the place where he produced scores of psychoactive substances. This place, probably not larger than 12 feet by 12 feet, looked more like the workshop of a medieval alchemist than a modern laboratory. The Shulgin project generated less enthusiasm in official circles. Richard Meyer, spokesman for the DEA's San Francisco Field Division, stated, "It is our opinion that those books are pretty much cookbooks on how to make illegal drugs. Agents tell me that in all clandestine labs that they have raided, they have found copies of those books." During the 40 years when irrational legislation killed all legitimate research, fascinating new psychoactive substances would not have been synthesized, discovered, and explored had it not been for dedicated individuals like the Shulgins, as well as other groups of researchers convinced of the scientific, psychological, and spiritual importance of psychedelics and entheogens. They carried on the informal exploration of these medicines and sacraments without official permission, taking advantage of legal loopholes and the slow pace of the criminalization of new substances. These enthusiastic explorers have amassed a large amount of invaluable information that could, in the future, serve as a basis for well-designed and organized research projects. During the last 30 years, Ralph Metzner, an experienced therapist and pioneer of psychedelic research, kept in contact with some of these groups in the USA and in Europe and collected data about their experiences with entheogenic tryptamine derivatives. He made this information available in his groundbreaking book, The Toad and the Jaguar. The main focus of this book is on a substance that seems particularly fascinating and promising, 5-methoxy-DMT, an active alkaloid of South American psychoactive snuffs and of the secretions of the parotid glands of the toad Bufo alvarius. The book provides detailed information concerning the phenomenology of the experiences, therapeutic effects, modes of administration, the dose-effect relationship, impact of various settings, combination of entheogenic sessions with various forms of spiritual practice, and the comparison of 5-methoxy-DMT with its cousins DMT and bufotenine. What is particularly interesting seems to be the potential of 5-methoxy-DMT as a future therapeutic agent, because it is sufficiently powerful to induce therapeutic and transformative effects within a time period that does not put unreasonable demands on the therapist's schedule and makes it easier to contain the experience. With this substance, significant healing and transformation can often be achieved in not much longer than one session of psychoanalysis. The Toad and the Jaguar is an extraordinary contribution to psychedelic literature that will one day be considered a classic. The information that it brings is sufficiently convincing to inspire clinical research of 5-methoxy-DMT. What immediately comes to mind is a study that would test the effects of this substance in the treatment of PTSD in veterans. It may have a good chance at approval because of the enormity of the psychiatric, economic, and political problems connected with this diagnostic category. Another important source of information about psychedelic therapy based on illicit clinical research is the book Therapy with Substance, Psycholytic Psychotherapy in the 21st Century by German physician Friederike Meckel-Fischer, who is living in Switzerland. She paid a great toll for her dedication to her patients. When it became known what work she was doing, she had to face tedious legal procedures and almost lost her medical license. The global renaissance of interest in psychedelic research. We are currently experiencing a remarkable worldwide renaissance of interest in the scientific research of psychedelic substances. This is an unexpected change after 4 decades during which official, legally sanctioned clinical work was virtually impossible. The credit for this remarkable turn of events goes to Rick Doblin and his enthusiastic team at the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, and their relentless effort to change this dismal situation. At present, new psychedelic research is being conducted at a number of American universities, including Harvard, Johns Hopkins, University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, State University of New York, SUNY, University of California in San Francisco, UCSF, University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, and others. The positive results of the groundbreaking research of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy with veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, spearheaded by Michael and Annie Mithoffer in South Carolina, is of special interest. According to official reports, more American soldiers stationed in Iraq and Afghanistan commit suicide because of PTSD than are killed by the enemy. And their suicidal and violent behavior continues after the soldiers return home. Since the formidable problems associated with this dangerous disorder resist traditional forms of therapy, this project might open the door for psychedelics into mainstream psychiatry. Phase 2 clinical trials of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD have been conducted in South Carolina, Colorado, Canada, and Israel, and Phase 3 clinical trials are beginning in 2018. New research projects involving various cannabinoids, ibogaine, ketamine, and other psychedelic substances have been initiated worldwide. Recently, unexpected justification for the work of the therapists who had decided to follow their own judgment and conscience rather than ignorant and misguided legislation came in the form of an open letter from a prominent former government official. Dr. Peter Bourne, who had been the White House drug czar during Jimmy Carter's presidency, wrote a remarkable letter to the editor after reading an article in The New Yorker by Michael Pollan. This article, The Trip Treatment, was about the use of psilocybin in medical treatment. In the letter, Bourne expressed his regret about the Carter government's unfortunate drug policy and apologized to researchers who had continued to work with psychedelics in spite of a wrong administrative decision. This is his letter. Pollan's article about using psychedelics in medical treatments offers a sad commentary on how government funding for scientific research is influenced heavily by political and cultural values that are unrelated to science. With few exceptions, federal support for research on so-called drugs of abuse has taken into consideration only their adverse effects, reinforcing the bias of policymakers and funders. As a former director of the White House Office of Drug Abuse Policy, I now feel a sense of shame at having failed to try to reverse the Nixon-Ford policy that placed most psychedelics on the DEA's Schedule I list, prohibiting their use. Congress would almost certainly have blocked this change, but had we been able to lift the ban on scientific research into medical applications, doctors would probably now have a far better understanding of brain function, and the unnecessary suffering of many terminally ill patients could have been alleviated. We should applaud the heroic scientists and clinicians Pollan mentions, who are clearly committed to advancing the frontiers of science. This letter might bring some satisfaction to the brave therapists who decided to be guided by scientific evidence and by their conviction that psychedelics were extremely useful therapeutic tools, rather than by irrational legislation engendered by mass hysteria. However, it cannot undo the damage that has been done to scientific progress and to the many thousands of patients who were deprived of the benefits of psychedelic treatment. I am very proud of my brother Paul, professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto, who, as chairman of the Expert Committee on Psychotropic Substances of the World Health Organization, WHO, opposed the decision to place MDMA in Schedule I, a category of substances with great abuse potential and no therapeutic value. Paul pointed out the many reports of therapists who had used MDMA informally, and had observed significant improvement in their clients with post-traumatic stress disorder. His suggestion to not reclassify MDMA and to conduct more research before a final decision was made represents the only situation in the history of WHO in which the committee did not reach a unanimous decision. As there was no precedent for such a situation, the WHO had to call two lawyers who debated for an hour and a half about how to deal with this situation. Finally, they came up with the solution that the chair can attach and publish an opposing position. Search for a Manchurian candidate. The history of psychonautics would not be complete without mentioning its shadow side. Not all inner journeys were taken with benevolent intentions, taken voluntarily, or even with the knowledge that it was happening. LSD, a colorless, tasteless, and incredibly potent substance, attracted the attention of secret services, intelligence agencies, and militaries worldwide. The CIA explored the potential of LSD to compromise foreign politicians and diplomats, and to conduct brainwashing. In the infamous MK-Ultra program, CIA agents introduced LSD into the San Francisco urban underworld and instructed hired prostitutes to secretly slip it into the drinks of their clients. They then observed through one-way screens how the substance changed the client's behavior. They also surreptitiously added LSD into the drinks of people in various public places and observed how they responded. The justification that the CIA gave for its agents' criminal behavior was that the information was needed because Communist Russia, North Korea, and China were using psychedelics to brainwash captured Americans. The military circles of various countries have been interested in LSD as a potential chemical weapon. One of the uses that was seriously considered was to contaminate the municipal water supply and use the resulting confusion to invade the afflicted cities. In experiments conducted with unsuspecting troops, soldiers secretly intoxicated with LSD and equipped with cameras attached to their guns were given specific tasks. Trained observers were assessing how accurate they were in aiming their guns, as well as other military activities. A different plan involved using LSD in aerosols and spraying the enemy's soldiers in the field. When I was working in the Psychiatric Research Institute in Prague, we had the opportunity to realize how widespread the interest was in the military use of LSD. We conducted a clinical study of Neomid, a tricyclic antidepressant produced by Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company. We observed that the patients from this study showed no response to LSD for a period of 3 weeks after the treatment was discontinued. We thought this was an interesting observation and published a small article about it in an obscure Czech journal called Activitas Nervosa Superior. Within a few weeks, we received, to our great surprise, more than 100 requests for reprints from different countries of the world, mostly from facilities related to the military. We could imagine a scenario in which this information could be seen as valuable. Soldiers pre-medicated with Neomid could operate safely in a territory contaminated by LSD. Laboratory psychonautics. So far, we have only explored psychonautics using psychedelic medicines. We should also add to this list the journeys mediated by various laboratory techniques for expanding consciousness. John Lilly, world-famous researcher of dolphin intelligence and experimenter with psychedelic substances, developed a sensory isolation, sensory deprivation tank, which induces holotropic states of consciousness by the significant reduction of meaningful sensory stimuli. John Lilly's research was initially conceived to provide important information for the military. It was based on the observation that soldiers placed in solitary outposts can experience profound changes in consciousness, and pilots on solitary flights develop irrational behavior, breakout phenomenon, or empty cockpit syndrome. Isolation was also known as one of the techniques used for interrogation and brainwashing. The early research of this phenomenon was inspired by the book Alone, written by Admiral Richard Byrd, American naval officer and polar explorer, who spent 6 months alone in an Antarctic station, gathering weather data and fulfilling his desire to taste peace and quiet long enough to know how good they really are. But early on, he began suffering inexplicable mental and physical disturbances. In the extreme form of the sensory deprivation tank, which John Lilly built at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, the person in the experiment is deprived of sensory input by submersion in a large, dark, and soundproof tank, about 2 meters high, filled with water at body temperature. Wearing a custom-made watertight mask and breathing through a plastic pipe, one can float in this tank for many hours like an embryo and experience a profound holotropic state of consciousness. A smaller version of the Lilly tank is in the shape of a large box lined with plastic, containing a solution of Epsom salt, magnesium sulfate, which makes it possible to float on its surface. A thermostat ensures the temperature is close to that of the human body. John Lilly also designed a luxury version in the shape of a flying saucer for private experimentation, called the White Whale. It has become very popular among modern psychonauts. Another well-known laboratory method of changing consciousness is biofeedback, developed by Elmer and Alice Green, Barbara Brown, and others. The subject is attached to an EEG machine and asked to relax and meditate. He or she is guided by electronic feedback signals into holotropic states of consciousness, characterized by the preponderance of certain specific frequencies of brain waves, alpha, theta, delta. The original machines were used for the feedback of acoustic signals of various frequencies. Using acoustic stimuli is not a very engaging method and can even interfere with the experiment. Barbara Brown made the biofeedback method more interesting by using a plexiglass lotus blossom with built-in electric lights of different colors assigned to specific frequencies. This lotus blossom starts glowing in darkness in a specific color when the subject produces a certain amount of waves of the desired frequency. In a version for children, the feedback could be provided by linking the production of a certain frequency of the brain waves with the movement of an electric train. We could also mention here the techniques of sleep and dream deprivation, studied by William Dement, and of lucid dreaming, developed by Stephen LaBerge, as well as various devices combining stroboscopic light, sound technology, body vibrations, kinesthetic stimulations, and others. It is important to emphasize that episodes of holotropic states of varying duration can also occur spontaneously, psycho-spiritual crises or spiritual emergencies. They are currently seen as a manifestation of mental illness, psychoses. Correctly understood and properly supported and treated, however, they can result in emotional and psychosomatic healing, positive personality transformation, and consciousness evolution. We will dedicate a special chapter later in the book to this important topic.